You're listening to the best of the Bradcast.
Bounce to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast. I'm Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off today, but we put together some of our favorite interviews for you. A best of the Bradcast. On today's show, Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance talks with Brad about her lawsuit calling for the results of Georgia's lieutenant governor's race to be tossed entirely. And after that, Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik debunks the Trump administration's false claims about California's water. So sit back and enjoy this best of the Bradcast.
The irreconcilably illegitimate race for governor in the great state of Georgia, that may be over with Republican Secretary of State and Voter Suppression Champion of the Year Brian Kemp overseeing his own tight race for governor against Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, who would have been the nation's first African-American female governor had she been able to overcome Kemp's massive voter suppression efforts before the election and during the counting, frankly. Such as more than a million voters were purged from the voting rolls in recent years. There were rejected absentee and provisional ballots for alleged signature mismatches in the state and other related techniques used to shave off votes, allowing Brian Kemp to avoid a runoff contest with Abrams by just 0.22%, or 0.22%. It also doesn't hurt that all the votes cast at the polling place on Election Day were cast on oft-failed, easily hackable, almost 20-year-old, 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting machines made by the now-defunct Diebold Election Systems, Inc. That only skims the surface of why we have long argued now that a win by Kemp at this point in the governor's race cannot possibly be seen as legitimate. To that end, Stacey Abrams has formed a new group called Fair Fight Georgia. They have filed a federal voter suppression lawsuit against Brian Kemp in the state of Georgia over what they allege to be gross mismanagement of the election, asking for paper ballots from here on out in Georgia's elections. Well, there's an idea. In the meantime, a lawsuit was filed over the holiday weekend in Georgia in the lieutenant governor's race between Democratic candidate Sarah Riggs Amico and Republican Jeff Duncan, who has now been certified as the winner by about 3.5 points in that race. But that lawsuit was not filed by the Democratic candidate in the lieutenant governor's race. It was filed by the Coalition for Good Governance, the nonpartisan nonprofit group that has filed several lawsuits over the past several months in the Peach State, challenging their use of 100% unverifiable touchscreen systems prior to the election, which the judge in the federal case had found to be completely unreliable for use in any election, before then allowing them to be used anyway instead of paper ballots just before the November 6th midterms, finding that a switch to the same paper ballots used for absentee voting but at the polling place would just cause too much chaos at the polls with such short notice. But their newest suit in Georgia calls for the results of the lieutenant governor's race to be tossed entirely. Really? Jordan Wilkie over at Who What Why reported a complaint filed late on Friday contesting the outcome of the lieutenant governor's race could provide a rare glimpse into the state's election infrastructure and an opportunity to audit its non-transparent voting machines. Is that even possible? Joining us now to explain what is possible and what isn't is the Coalition for Good Governance's executive director, longtime election integrity champion, and friend of both BradBlog.com and the Bradcast, Marilyn Marks, who, like me, is still fighting for every vote and every voter from the November 6, 2018 midterm elections. Marilyn, welcome back to the Bradcast. I hope you have been able to get a little bit of rest since Election Day out there.
Brad, not a chance yet. It won't be for a while. As you know, we've spent the last several days filing this newest lawsuit.
Yep.
Very last minute, got it in just under the wire on Friday night. And so there's not going to be any rest for the Georgia weary for a while.
Understood. And I have a lot of questions about that lawsuit that I want to get to. But we've had you on a bunch of times over the past months now to discuss the various nightmares. Well, thank you for being there to do it. But we haven't had you on since Election Day to discuss how things actually went on Election Day and how things are still going there now with your lawsuit and with several important runoff elections coming up in Georgia from the midterms, including for Secretary of State. Will they once again be using the unverifiable touchscreen voting systems in this runoff?
Sadly, Brad, they are indeed. They're using them despite all of warnings, and you know all of the warnings that they have had, every group from the federal court to the National Academy of Science has warned them not to do this.
I mean, there's only like two races on the ballot, Secretary of State and Public Service Commissioner, as I recall. How hard would that be to not only hand mark a paper ballot, but hell, you could hand count those ballots in no time flat.
That's for sure, Brad. But unfortunately, the Secretary of State has taken, and the local election officials keep taking the position that somehow that's just too hard for Georgians to do, that it would just be too confusing for them to have to pick up a pen and color in the ovals.
And now,
I think that's rather insulting.
It is. But as I understand it, in order to use these touchscreens again, basically 1 month after the November 6th general election, they're reprogramming the computers, the touchscreens that were used on Election Day, in violation of their own state law, which says they must not disturb those machines for 1 month after the election. Is that correct?
That is correct, Brad, and you know, Jordan Wilkie also wrote about this, the fact that they are absolutely violating their own law. And just within the last few hours, we have had yet another fight with the Secretary of State's office about this. Not only did we need those machines preserved for our core case, the election security case that's in federal court, but also we certainly need them in this new case that challenges the election results for the lieutenant governor's race. We have continued to, over the last week and then yet again this afternoon, said to the Secretary of State, your rule, your own election code says they cannot touch these machines, the internal memory, for 1 month if there is no election contest pending. Now there is an election contest pending. Obviously, they are needed as evidence, mm-hmm. And the Secretary, as of today, is continuing to take the position that overriding the data, uploading new ballot programming for the December 4th runoff, and putting these machines out in unsecured voting places, mm-hmm. somehow does not make the internal memory data at risk. That's just foolish in anyone's mind.
And I want to talk about how that will actually affect the lieutenant governor's the contest that you filed, the lawsuit that you filed. But before I get to that, let me very quickly ask you about this lawsuit. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it. It was just filed. I have not yet had a chance to read it. This was filed by Stacey Abrams, her team, her new group, Fair Fight Georgia. Did they say they intend to contest the elections in Georgia in general, the way they're run, but not their actual, not her actual election for governor? Is that how you understand this lawsuit as well?
Yes, that's right. And Brad, I've had about 3 minutes to skim through it, mm-hmm. and it's a 66-page complaint, so I've certainly not had chance to digest it. But you're right. They are making general allegations about the method of voting, voter registration, mm-hmm. all of the voter suppression, the mechanics of voting, even on the DRE machines. They are taking a very broad brush approach to Georgia's very questionable voting system, and they are asking a federal court for prospective relief. No doubt this will be a very hard-fought, very long, it will have a very, very long lead time on it, I think, for this case. They are not, you know, asking to overturn any of the elections. In fact, it is too late to do that. The deadlines have now passed. Well, and we filed on the deadline for the lieutenant governor's race. And so there are no more races that can be contested.
Okay, so you guys did that on the last day for the lieutenant governor's race. And one,
that's correct.
One more question before I get to that. Your group, Coalition for Good Governance, and other voting rights groups, Common Cause, ACLU, and so forth, filed a number of lawsuits before the election and even during the November 6th contest. But did the Abrams campaign and the state Democrats in general join you in those suits? For example, your fight to get a hand-marked paper ballot for every voter in Georgia? Or did they otherwise take action to avoid what I now see in the governor's race as a completely illegitimate election?
No, sadly they didn't. They focused their resources on get-out-the-vote work. And their idea was that if they could get out the vote, that somehow they could mitigate for all of these fundamental process problems. And I think that theory was shown to be far too optimistic, because there were too many voters that got caught in a system of not having their votes counted. And then we have no idea how many had their machine votes flipped, not counted backwards. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unknown. But now I think people realize that, Brad, all of these warnings that you've been giving, how many years now? Like 16, 18 years?
Yeah.
And the specific warnings that we gave in our lawsuits and before, those warnings now became quite tangible. They are no one can any longer think of them as theoretical. But sadly, the Democratic Party and the Abrams campaign did not join us in the prophylactic measures that could have been taken to avoid this. What we had hoped is that the Abrams campaign and the Democratic Party would go to each county, each of the 159 counties in Georgia. They all have local election boards that are bipartisan, with Democrats and Republicans appointed by their parties. Each of them could have chosen paper ballots. 159 counties chose on their bipartisan local county boards not to.
When you say that Democrats had hoped to mitigate any problems with get out the vote, is this the idea that I've heard from many Democrats over the years, is that, we just have to turn out in such huge numbers that they could not possibly steal the election, that voter suppression won't end up costing us the race? Is that the notion that you saw the Democrats working on there? And does this election prove that doesn't work? I mean,
well, of course, it's just one woman's opinion, but that appeared to be the approach they took. They really did 100% offense, very little defense, and the work that we saw taking place in terms of poll watchers and that sort of work was pretty traditional, I will call it, as opposed to really challenging some of the many wrong things that were happening throughout early voting and in the polling place, and then documenting, as we would like to have seen documented, the errors so that they could have been challenged more easily. I think that almost every person on the ballot, in all the ballot questions, certainly had a basis for a challenge had enough been documented. Lieutenant Governor, we have a little different situation. We'll come back and talk to that. But I think that Democrats hopefully will take a lesson from this, that you cannot overcome these fundamental efforts, whether it's a hacking of a machine, manipulation of a machine, or even unintentional programming errors. you can't bet on overcoming that with turnout.
And that's, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of election integrity advocates are born after they have lost an election, which is why we try to raise these issues before it becomes an issue. And to that end, let's move to your newest lawsuit in Georgia, where Jordan Wilkie at Who What Why reports your suit will attempt to prove that there were enough irregularities in the lieutenant governor's race between Democrat Sarah Riggs Amico and Republican Jeff Duncan to, as the complaint charges, to place doubt in the results. As of now, Duncan, the Republican, was certified the winner with 51.63% of the vote to Riggs Amico's 48.37. That's a fairly sizable, almost 3.5-point margin. So why should those results be in doubt, Marilyn Marks, according to your lawsuit?
Well, when you begin to read the complaints that voters turned in, that voters are calling us about, there were just innumerable reports of voters who didn't have this race show up on their electronic ballot.
Didn't show up at all on the race.
Apparently they didn't. It didn't show up until some people, in fact, did find it on their review screen, their summary screen, that, you know, how as you scroll through and you do your votes and just before you hit the cast my ballot button, you know, it gives you a review. Well, for many voters, apparently that's the first time they saw the lieutenant governor race. And then apparently one of two things happened for those this particular subset of folks. One of two things happened. Either they were able to then go back and make a selection in the lieutenant governor race, or in many cases, apparently, when they got to the review screen, staring at it, trying to get ready to cast a vote, or excuse me, to make a correction, without even touching the screen, it automatically casts the vote, and the message comes up. Thank you for voting. Your vote was cast. We've seen many, many complaints from voters on the fact that they never had the chance. Once they realized that they had not been able to vote in the lieutenant governor's race, and even before they started to take action, to put their hand over the machine to do it, that it was too late. The ballot was cast.
And I got to say that we don't know, of course, because, you know, we don't have a videotape of this happening. It happens so quickly, and the vote is already cast. And at that point, there's nothing that can be done about it. And so you could have people saying, well, I meant to vote in that race, but I didn't because I couldn't, et cetera. But we actually have evidence that I believe you filed with your lawsuit here showing some kind of remarkable data in what you describe as the residual vote, and that is a residual vote is a vote where a ballot where there is no vote at all for the candidate, or there is an overvote. In other words, they voted for too many people for that candidate. In any event, the computers show no vote in that race, correct? That's a residual vote?
That's correct.
All right.
Right.
The charts filed with your lawsuit for the residual votes in the lieutenant governor's race, in other words, where no vote was recorded, is way, way higher than any of the other statewide races. It's almost twice that of all of the these races that are farther down on the ballot, like Secretary of State,
right,
Insurance Commissioner, School Superintendent,
Agriculture Commissioner, not things that are... Yeah, this is the lieutenant governor's race is the second highest office in the state, and some people don't understand. The residents of Georgia do, but maybe outside of Georgia, the lieutenant governor is also the president of the Senate and basically controls all of the legislation coming through the Capitol. So it is a very powerful position. You know, how could we believe that there is more interest in the commissioner of insurance, commissioner of agriculture, public service commission race than the lieutenant governor race?
Yeah, it's not even close. And then just in case people think, oh, okay, well, maybe people are interested in the agriculture commissioner in Georgia, but not so much the lieutenant governor. No, that's not the case if we compare year over year, comparing the 2018 election with the 2014 election. The residual rates for all of those races were pretty much all in line for governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, ag commissioner, and so forth back in 2014. But in 2018, again, boom, lieutenant governor through the roof with residual votes. What could possibly explain this at this point, Marilyn?
Well, when people give me, and they've given me some pretty silly explanations, which I won't even bore you with, but when you say, but now wait a minute, there was no meaningful drop-off at all if we just look at paper ballots. You know, I don't know if you had a chance to see that in the filing, mm-hmm. Brad, but if you look at the mail-in ballots and the provisional ballots, there was virtually no drop-off.
So the only drop-off,
the only on the machines,
on the touchscreen, only the residual rate of no vote at all for lieutenant governor, that only happened on the touchscreens, not on the paper ballots. And there were a lot of paper ballots, a lot of mail-in, because Stacey Abrams had been pushing for vote by mail for a lot of people. The rate is all the same for on the paper ballots.
Or very close. Very close. It was much more traditional. Yes, yeah, some people go and only vote the top race, but it was very, very close to nothing in terms of the level of voting for lieutenant governor when you look at the paper ballots. So what this tells us is that the undervote is related only to the machines. Now, please explain that.
I was hoping you could. You got the lawsuit. I can't. I mean, if we're focusing only on this problem only happening on the machines, and it's clearly a problem when you look at this data, and happening only on the machines, that means it is either a nefarious hack or something of some sort, or misprogramming, a less nefarious misprogramming. It's got to be one or the other, doesn't it? And what if so? What does your lawsuit ask as the remedy here?
Well, certainly the remedy is to rerun the election on a verifiable, evidence-based process. We just cannot have people have an election where you just have to guess at what the on various theories as to what the result was. So yes, it could be a programming error, it could be a hack, but what we do know is all machines did not behave the same. We have people prepared, willing to give us affidavits that say, as far as I could tell, my machine showed no problem. You know, she was on the first page of my ballot.
Mm-hmm.
I had no issue. My electronic ballot. You know, I had no issue. Voted all the way through. It's fine. Now we have many other people who did not have that. So there were clearly problems in some machines and not others. But yet they were all programmed. Every single machine is identical, and every machine was programmed by the Secretary of State's office. So what could be causing this glitch? We don't know right now, Brad, and of course that's why we are seeking the preservation of this electronic evidence, and that is why we will be asking for discovery, and we may be going into the court as early as tomorrow with a motion to try to preserve this equipment, because the officials are recklessly avoiding preserving the equipment.
And that's what it takes us. I've just got a minute or two left here, Marilyn Marks, but that takes us back to the earlier point. Has the evidence in question here, these machines, has the evidence now been destroyed because the machines have been reprogrammed for the runoff coming up in those other races on Tuesday?
So, Brad, we're hoping that there are still machines that have not been reprogrammed, because this particular runoff is going to see such a low turnout, and there are fewer early voting places, mm-hmm. for example. There will be fewer machines used in the precincts, and as a result, we believe that there will be some machines that will not be scheduled for reprogramming, and we're trying to catch them before there's any chance that they are put through reprogramming.
And will you be allowed to have experts examine those machines? Because for years they don't let anybody examine them. So will that be allowed in this suit for a forensic study?
Well, it will be up to the judge, but I can't imagine how a judge is going to say no. You've presented all of this evidence that there was some kind of problem. Machines were behaving differently from polling place A to polling place B. I'm not going to let you figure out why. It's hard to imagine that the judge is going to do that, given the level of evidence we have now. And, yep. Brad, I think the thing that is different now than what we've had in the past, you know, we've worked on this unverifiable voting in the courts now for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have court rulings that say this is not a reasonable method of voting. These machines are not reliable. We've got, you know, court opinions that say this is highly questionable. Therefore, I think that a judge in a election case can now more easily look to court opinions,
mm-hmm.
court rulings that give this judge the basis of saying, yeah, there is plenty of reason,
yep.
that a hard look needs to be taken.
Yeah, your judge.
So I'm hopeful that our past work will be of a real investment that pays benefits now.
Yep, you're right. Your judge should certainly be sympathetic to these concerns, given that you warned about all of these concerns in advance, and now they seem to have potentially come to pass in the lieutenant governor's race. Marilyn, before I let you go very quickly, is Sarah Riggs Amico, the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, she is not joining your suit as a plaintiff, is she? And if not, why not?
Well, no, she is not joining. We are doing this, Brad, on a nonpartisan, as we do all our work, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing this on a nonpartisan basis on behalf of voters. We are not doing this on the part of the Democratic Party or of Sarah Amico. In fact, I only met Sarah for the first time and ever so briefly last week. I've never had any contact with her before. And this is something we decided we wanted to do because of the machines, the data, the problems that we showed, not because of a political reason. As you know, I'm a Republican.
Yep.
And one of my lawyers on this is a Republican, and one of our plaintiffs is a Libertarian. So we're coming at this from a standpoint of having a election integrity or election process in Georgia that has integrity, not for any partisan reasons.
Marilyn Marks, Executive Director of the Coalition for Good Governance. You can find them at coalitionforgoodgovernance.org. You can and should follow Marilyn on the Twitters at Marilyn R. Marks 1. That's the number one, Marilyn R. Marks 1. And I hope you will consider supporting the work that the coalition does, because there is really nobody out there fighting these fights, certainly in advance of, you know, when an election goes south, but now even after an election, to try to figure out what the hell happened. Marilyn Marks, thank you for your efforts, and stay
thank
in touch.
Thank you, Brad.
Look forward to hearing how
we'll
this lawsuit
you.
Goes. Thank you.
We'll keep you posted. Thanks.
You
bye-bye.
Bet.
That was Brad's conversation with Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance back in November. Coming up next, Brad's interview with Michael Hiltzik of the LA Times from August. I'm producer Desi Doyen, and you're listening to the best of the Bradcast. You're listening to the best of the Bradcast.
All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As record wildfires continue to rage now up and down the great state of California, the Trump administration is taking the opportunity not to help the thousands of firefighters in the state battle the record blazes, including one that is now the largest in state history. Instead, they seem to have decided not to let a good catastrophe go to waste, especially when it's in their mortal enemy state of California, I guess, when they can otherwise use these disasters as an excuse to change largely unrelated policies that right-wingers have long wanted to change. even if they have nothing at all to do with the immediate disaster of record wildfires in a record hot summer fueled by climate change's global warming, which the administration continues, as you know, to regard as a myth and a hoax anyway. Now, I don't usually like to focus on Donald Trump's ridiculous statements and rallies and Twitter feed, but here I need to, for a moment, focus on some of his tweets, since his curious and wildly ignorant tweets about the California wildfires over the past few days appear to signal a new effort by the administration to change a number of major federal policies that, in truth, have nothing to do with fighting wildfires or why they are now so difficult to fight in the first place here in the Golden State. Many are focusing on the silliness of his tweets, but overlooking why he appears to be saying what he is saying, and that seems a mistake to me. But let's start with the tweet itself. As Emily Atkin notes at the New Republic several days ago, last year was the deadliest and most destructive wildfire season in California's history. But she says that could soon change. As the state now enters the peak month of fire season, wildfires have already burned more than 290,000 acres and killed 8 people. This time last year, in what had been the most deadly and destructive season in state history, only about 220,000 acres had burned by this time, and no one had died. The 2017 season would eventually claim 44 lives. Now, since then, I should note, officials have pegged the number of burnt acreage to as much as 400,000 acres this year, with about 1,100 homes destroyed to date. Why are these wildfires so bad, and why do they seem to be getting worse over time? Atkin asks. Well, President Donald Trump offered his opinion in a Sunday night tweet, writing that, quote, bad environmental laws have been diverting water away from firefighting efforts into the Pacific Ocean. He also wrote that the state, quote, must tree clear to stop fire spreading. Presented with Trump's tweet, the state firefighting agency, Atkin notes, said that it had no idea what he was talking about. Dan Berlant, assistant deputy director at Cal Fire, told the New York Times, we have plenty of water to fight these wildfires, but let's be clear, it's our changing climate that is leading to more severe and destructive fires. Longtime Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik has been similarly trying over the past week to make sense of Trump's tweets and what they really mean for the ongoing disaster here in California and future changes to long-standing federal laws and environmental regulations. Michael Hiltzik is the Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and business columnist, where he has served as a financial and political writer, an investigative reporter, a technology writer and editor, and a foreign correspondent in Africa and Russia. He's also the author of several books, including Big Science, Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex, and the New York Times bestseller Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. Michael Hiltzik, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks. It's good to be on with you.
You reported last week, Michael, that on at least one of the big reasons that likely explains Trump's bizarre tweets about California's wildfires, about, quote, where he said, bad environmental laws which aren't allowing massive amount of readily available water to be properly utilized, and then his odd reference to diverting water into the oceans, you know, as rivers do all by themselves. But before we get to what you have found that might explain the tweet in reality as far as policy goes, you describe the tweet itself as, quote, some sort of award, that it deserves some sort of award for most glaring misstatements about climate change and water policy in the smallest number of words ever. So let me allow you, Michael, to defend that charge. Why is it, as you and others charge, that his tweet is such an ignorant misstatement of the problem at hand?
Well, as you pointed out, you know, just a moment or two ago, Trump seemed to be arguing that that environmental laws, bad or good or whatever, were diverting water that was needed to fight these fires. And as Cal Fire has told me and many others, there's just simply no truth to that. There is more than enough water on site to fight these fires. The fires in Northern California surround huge reservoirs. Cal Fire and firefighters are drawing from those reservoirs all the time. There's no crisis. There's no shortage. And in any case, water is just one of the many devices or many instruments that firefighters use to fight wildfires, and it's by no means the most important. So there's that. Bad environmental laws. Trump wasn't very clear as to which laws he was talking about, but as I pointed out, the fact is that the environmental laws that have contributed to the fire situation are laws that he has abrogated by withdrawing the United States from climate change conferences and undermining greenhouse gas regulations and what have you. And that all contributes to the hot and dry conditions and the drought conditions that have contributed to these wildfires over time. So diverted to the Pacific Ocean, as you pointed out, water goes to the Pacific Ocean. That's where the waters in our rivers go. The diversions are the diversion of water for growers in the Central Valley of California who live in one of the very few Republican zones in the state and are basically supported by the very few Republican office holders we have in Congress.
And for people not in California who may not understand, Republicans have long argued that the way California is using water is actually the reason for the years-long drought that we have been fighting out here, facing out here, not the actual, you know, lack of things like rain and snowfall during these years. These are actually drought deniers, Michael, who think we don't have a drought here at all. And if I recall, during the, I want to say it was during the 2016 election, didn't Donald Trump also say something along those lines, that we have plenty of water out here in California, we're just misusing it?
Yes, Trump during the campaign sort of emerged as the drought denier in chief. And that was after he came up to the Central Valley and met with a lot of those Republican congressmen and the growers in the Central Valley who don't get as much water as they want for legal reasons more than anything else. And that's because they have very junior water rights in this very complex system we have in the state. And they have to wait until other users get their water before they do, and they also have to wait under federal law for environmental uses to be served, and that means water has to be kept flowing through a lot of our rivers so that fish and fishermen and fisheries are supported, and we don't let those species go extinct. And when I say going extinct, it's not only fish that are at risk of going extinct, but as I've reported, there are salmon fishermen on the coast whose livelihoods are at risk of going extinct because the salmon are being stressed by federal policies that don't allow enough water to flow down the rivers they use.
Now, is there anything to the argument that Republicans have been putting forward and complaining about for years that, in fact, the lack of water in the right-leaning Central Valley here in California is due to bad policies, whether it's to protect endangered species or the billion-dollar California salmon industry? Are there changes that could be made that are legitimate as opposed to just the whining and the drought denial we've seen for so many years from some of these folks?
Well, so bad policy is in the eye of the beholders. The growers who are complaining, they think it's bad policy because they don't get as much water as they want. And look, in this state, water in many parts of the state is a very scarce resource. And the only way to deal with it is to have a balanced system that serves all of the stakeholders as well as we can, and that means that the growers, they're one category of stakeholders, but fish and fishermen and environmental needs, that's another group of stakeholders, and urban users like myself, who get water imported from Central and Northern California so that we have water to drink and wash our clothes in, we're another group of stakeholders, and there are a lot of state agencies and experts who are trying to work out a balanced policy so that everybody gets served. The growers think that any water that goes to users who are not themselves is bad policy, and they blame it all on leftist environmentalists, and that's a quote from some of their supporters in Congress, and it's simply wrong. That's first of all, it's not true. Second of all of the allocations of water that are being done are done in accordance with state and even more so federal law, which is very clear about where the priorities are and how this water needs to be apportioned. Within those limits, state agencies and judges have worked out deals and mandates, but you know, everybody is in this together. There's not, in many ways, there's not enough water to go around, although there could be if we did more conservation and the growers did wiser conservation. But the growers are not number one, and they don't come first. And there's nothing about bad environmental laws. There's nothing about diversion that really tells us why they don't get as much water they want. It's really water rights and its competing needs that are legitimate needs.
The Endangered Species Act, you would go on to report in a subsequent column over this past week, seems to be at the heart, as much as we can make sense of Donald Trump's tweet, seems to be at the heart of what he might be trying to do here. And I want to talk about that in a moment. But there's also this notion of federal versus state control, period. I cited Emily Atkin at the top of this segment here. She writes that Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke traveled to two reservoirs in the northern San Joaquin Valley recently, where he told reporters that his agency may intervene. There is, quote, there is a federal interest, the federal interest as the water master, he said. He was joined by Republican congressman from Central California, Jeff Denham, who called the state's water conservation proposal a, quote, disastrous plan to flush water from valleys to the ocean. Flush waters from valleys to the ocean. Foreshadowing the language that Trump would eventually use about diverting water. There has seems to be a battle royale brewing, if not already underway, between federal and state control of a lot of these issues, whether it's the mileage and emissions standards or the use of water here. I find it ironic, given that, you know, Republicans are always talking about states' rights, and here the feds, they want to use the feds to to Bigfoot the state. But is this about the feds being able to determine, rather than the state, how the state will use its own water?
Well, I think this administration would like to, but this is not really about state rights in the abstract. You know, state rights, as we hear about it, is sort of a constitutional principle. This is about law and federal law, and Zinke is simply wrong. The fact of the matter is that all the federal laws that apply to the allocation of water in California, including water from projects that the federal government funded, the law says that water has to be allocated in accordance with state law. It's very explicit about that. So for Zinke to suggest that he can preempt state law, he is simply wrong. And if he has any doubt about that, we would say he needs to go back to a Supreme Court ruling in the 1970s that was written by William Rehnquist, who nobody would mistake for a liberal Democrat, which said,
not back then, Michael. They might call him a liberal Democrat now, but I take your point. Go ahead.
Right. Well, he certainly wasn't then.
Right.
And this was before he was even Chief Justice, in a case entitled California v. United States, Rehnquist made it very clear that the state's rules are what apply, and the federal government doesn't have the authority to countermand them. But that hasn't stopped Zinke and Trump from saying that they can and should, and they've written letters basically threatening the state of California with a lawsuit if the state exercises its clear legal authority. So that's developing. I think it's perfectly possible that this administration will try to launch that fight, but it doesn't have the law behind it, and it's most likely going to lose.
So that's on the Interior Department side with Ryan Zinke, and then there seems to be this other element that you also report on this week at the Los Angeles Times, the Endangered Species Act. You had argued several days ago that an order issued Wednesday by Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to the National Marine Fisheries Service and its parent agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. And by the way, I had no idea that NOAA was actually part of the Commerce Department here. But in any event, this directive directs the agencies to facilitate access to the water needed to fight the ongoing wildfires affecting the state of California. Well, that's good. It then gives away the game, you argue, by making specific reference to the Federal Endangered Species Act, quote, consistent with the emergency consultation provisions under the ESA. Federal agencies may use any water as necessary to protect life and property in the affected areas. So what does that order tell you, Mr. Hiltzik, about what they're doing here?
I think we could unpack that a bit. First of all, the Trump administration has had the knives out for the Endangered Species Act for more than a year. And the reason that it's doing that in California is because It's court rulings under the Endangered Species Act that made sure that water did flow down the rivers and didn't go first to the growers. So the growers have been on the warpath saying, oh, you know, we're not getting water and we're drying up because of these biological opinions that say the fish need the water. These are biological opinions that were issued in accordance with the Federal Endangered Species Act. So Trump has been out for the ESA from the get-go. Now, what Ross did the other day was he invoked the ESA to say, we're going to abrogate the ESA, we're going to declare an emergency here if we can, so that we don't have to serve the rivers and we don't have to send the water down the rivers for the endangered species that is the fish. We're going to use it to protect, as he put it, protect life and property in the affected areas. And once again, what he was referring to is the fire zone, and he was suggesting that the water that was going down the rivers was needed to fight the fires. And as we've already said, that's just wrong. Mm-hmm. I would go further. I'd say that's a lie, because Ross and Trump have been told over and over again over the last week or weeks that the water is not needed to fight the fire. So essentially they're trying to bootstrap this fire crisis that we have to enable them to try to undermine the Endangered Species Act. It's transparent. It's not going to go. It's certainly not going to happen without litigation. And by the time that litigation goes through the court, we're going to be out of the 2018 fire season and well into the 2019 season, maybe even the 2020 season. So the real subtext here is once again an effort to serve the growers, and these are big agribusinesses, by the way. They're mm-hmm. not mom and pop farmers. They're huge almond orchards and pistachio orchards that have been planted by very wealthy agribusiness corporate growers mm-hmm. on the assumption that they would have a steady stream of water. And when they don't get the water they need, their trees die, and that's why they are desperate. They made a mistake. They planted crops that aren't really suitable for the water situation in California, and now they're moving heaven and earth and exerting all sorts of political influence to get water that they actually don't have a right to.
Michael Hiltzik, why does the farming industry in California get so much more love than the fishing industry, the billion-dollar fishing industry, the salmon industry, and so forth? That's a huge industry as well. Is there just that much of a disparity between the amount of money that comes into farmers versus fishermen, or is it the amount of money that they give to these politicians? What explains that disparity?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Number one, yes, salmon is a billion-dollar industry. That is, when there are salmon to catch and when the salmon season is allowed to be 5 months long, as it is, you know, in a healthy period of time, as opposed to 6 weeks long, which is what it's like this year. But a billion-dollar industry, that sounds big, but it's small compared to the agriculture industry in California, which is many, many times larger. Another aspect of this is that the growers are big businesses. They're big corporations. They're, you know, they're Dole, they're Del Monte sized businesses. The fishing industry is made up of a lot of small players, and they simply don't have the political clout that big agribusiness does. And as a result, I think most people in California and maybe outside the state think of California as essentially a breadbasket, where you know, all of these fruits and vegetables, all the produce that you get across the country, that's California. They're not really aware of these other livelihoods that depend on water in the state. You know, it seems sort of tangential to think of, well, you know, somebody who goes out and fishes for salmon in the ocean actually depends on the salmon getting a healthy supply of water inland so that they can spawn, and then they go out to the ocean where they can be caught. So I think people don't really grasp, they don't really grasp what's going on here, and I've tried through my own reporting to bring that to people's attention, but it's hard because the growers are big. They have a lot of money for advertising. They have a lot of money for political lobbying. They have a lot of money for political contributions, and they spend that money.
Yeah, I think you pointed out in one of your columns this week that the salmon industry saw 95% of juveniles wiped out back in, was it 2014 and 2015, because the worst of the drought, we had to release the water from Shasta Lake, and it was too warm.
Well, I mean, that was during the drought, but the water was released from Shasta Lake, which is our largest reservoir, to serve the growers. And as a result of that, the water in Shasta Lake that was then passed into the rivers was hot, or relatively hot, and it boiled the small fry and destroyed the salmon catch. And that, once again, it wasn't the drought so much, it was this determination to make water releases to serve the growers that really just fried the fry, so to speak, and created this huge crisis. And yes, the figure that we have is 97% of the salmon smolts in the Sacramento River, which is a key supplier of salmon to the ocean, were destroyed in those 2 years.
David Bernhardt, the Deputy Secretary of the Interior, I don't know if you saw this, he published an op-ed in Washington Post today talking about we need to update the Endangered Species Act on, quote, market-based solutions and collecting data about the economic impacts of protecting these species. Michael, last thought here. You seem to suggest in these cases, when it comes to the feds versus the state on water policy, and when it comes to the Endangered Species Act, that the law is on, let's say, the good guys' side here. Should we worry? It sounds like the law is on the good guys' side, and hopefully this is just, you know, years of court battles. But is there real reason to be concerned about what the Trump administration is doing here?
Well, let me start by giving you a little bit of background about David Bernhardt, who's you know, one of the number two or number three man at Interior, and who wrote that op-ed. David Bernhardt, before he joined the federal government, was a lobbyist for the Westlands Water District, which is the largest private water district that we're talking about. It's a junior, it has junior water rights. It's where a lot of these almond and pistachio trees are planted. It's got Westlands has a real interest in changing the law so it gets more water. And here's Bernhardt, who used to be their lobbyist and their lawyer. So that should tell you right there what's really going on here. The fact is that the Endangered Species Act is not a component of a market economy. It's there because if the free market is left to its own devices, these species will die. And the whole point of having an Endangered Species Act is to make sure that they survive despite all of these economic interests that are lined up to kill them off. And, basically David Bernhardt is talking the book of the people who used to employ him when he was in private practice. And I don't think his assertions about the need to have a cost-benefit calculation to protect species, endangered species, really has any credibility whatsoever.
Just more regulatory capture, I'm afraid, of our federal agencies. At the end of Michael Hiltzik's LA Times column this week, headlined, Trump's minions are using California wildfires as excuse to attack endangered species protections. He writes, anyone concerned with trying to fashion rational water policy in the face of politically self-interested interference out of Washington should take heed. The Trump administration just signaled that it will stop at nothing, no matter how illogical. Michael Hiltzik, I hope people do take heed and follow your important work on this over at latimes.com. You can also follow Michael on the Twitters at HiltzikM. Michael Hiltzik, greatly appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast.
Thanks. I'm happy to be there with you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks to Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance, Michael Hiltzik of the Los Angeles Times, and to you for joining us for today's Best of the Bradcast and spending part of your day with us. You can find, follow, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. And as ever, our thanks to those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. We'll be back soon. I'm Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. Good luck, world.